The podcast Campus Files is back with more stories of scandal, crime, and intrigue on college campuses.
It is not hard to destroy a college.
It's almost like a university under siege.
Listen to and follow Campus Files, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
The Dawn Show on Talk Radio 1210 WPHT and the Free Odyssey app.
He used the word unfortunately when telling us that a deal has been reached, saying he is not happy with the outcome. The deal comes as the city's largest municipal workers union had just entered day 9 of this strike. Both sides met for this latest round of talks yesterday afternoon. DC33's president told us it is a 3-year deal. He wouldn't go into detail, but said some kind of wage increase is included. He said they did what they thought was in the best interest of their members.
The city of Philadelphia has to do better by its members, has to put the members and the workers who handle all the essential functions as a priority in the city. I don't feel like that's been done.
Philadelphia's Mayor Sherelle Parker released this statement. She says the new 3-year contract, coupled with the 1-year extension they agreed to last fall, will increase DC 33 members' pay by 14% over her 4 years in office. We know the union all along had been asking for 15% over 3 years. We are expecting to hear more from the mayor later this morning, and the union says they'll share more, too, in a statement. So
we'll get the details. And I don't know how you view that, but Greg Boulware not happy, the president of the DC 33 of the union there. So they were, I think sometimes when you're tough, it's a tough, tough deal to negotiate these things. And I think it just shows you if both sides have, they're a little contentious, maybe that means that it was a deal that was hard fought, and hopefully the union members themselves feel appreciated, because we appreciate you. These are some of the hardest working individuals. I cannot say this strongly enough. If the mayor wants to cut or trim the budget, trim it with all the different staffing and the people who got raises and work within City Hall. And a lot of them just came back to work for the first time in years, which is cray cray, if you ask me. All right. Our friend Terry Tracy, Broad and Liberty, he's brilliant. He's awesome. And he's here with some breaking news. Hey, Terry. Terry Tracy.
Cray cray. Cray cray indeed, Dawn. Good morning. You're always too kind, but I appreciate it.
Thank you. And you had actually...
It's been a little while.
Yeah, it has been a while. That's what I realized. I'm like, what's going on with Terry Tracy? I haven't, broadandliberty.com. I haven't talked to Terry in a little bit. We got to update.
Just having all the fun. Yeah, all the fun at Broad and Liberty. It's that, just listening to the intro there with the news bit, it's a tough situation. I mean, it's a reminder of how precarious the situation in city government in particular, but a lot of these county governments all over the region really is right now, that the fiscal situation is increasingly unstable. Mm-hmm. And the macro pressures are not going to, be substantially mitigated, I don't think, anytime soon, particularly given what Josh Shapiro is doing in Harrisburg right now. And, we are one crisis away in many of these governments from not being able to pay the bills and provide basic services to taxpayers who are already significantly leveraged. And so while there's a lot to debate about, whether the outcome with Mayor Parker and Greg Boulware is good or bad or what, when you zoom out, I think it should be a reminder of really how precarious the fiscal situation in the Philadelphia region in southeastern Pennsylvania is right now.
Yeah, and they never think about, to your point, Terry Tracy, they never say, in this one, it's they look at the hardest working individuals who, by the way, starting salaries in the mid 40, 45-ish thousand range. I mean, I know that there are those who make nearly double that with overtime and whatnot, let's say for sanitation, but these are hardworking individuals, as opposed to Philadelphia City Hall, where you have a lot of layers of bureaucracy, you have big staffs and a lot of perks. That's where I would cut. They never do.
No doubt. Why don't you start with City Council while you're at it?
Amen.
One of the most ineffectual legislative bodies on the planet Earth. And then the other piece too is when you look at the mayor's budget, there's a lot about Mayor Parker that I think, and she's I guess she's sort of like the tallest midget of the circus coming off of Jim Kenney. But like, there's a lot that she's done that I think is encouraging or feels just sort of like she's an effective cheerleader for the city. She seems to be at the backs of our police. She has a sensible sort of tough on crime. Like, there's good things there, right? I don't think you want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. But when I look at this budget and I look at her housing plan, it's a tremendous amount of money. Who's getting that money? And I'm not sure that they're even solving for the right thing. I don't know that housing stock is really the issue. I think the issue is poverty. And if you had less poverty, you would have more vibrant neighborhoods, and the housing stock that is in the city would be sufficient for its current population. So I'd rather see all that money that's in this sort of housing boondoggle go to the people that are doing some of the hardest jobs in the world and feeling all the inflationary pressures that all the rest of us are feeling. And, you know, like, let's do a much more practical review of how we're spending taxpayer dollars.
So if Terry Tracy, who's a very busy guy and CEO of Broad Liberty, but let's just say you're mayor, what are your top priorities for the city of Philadelphia, and how do you implement them given what any mayor, but especially this mayor, inherited, and the pushbacks from city council?
I know it's not, well, if you're sort of controlling for the inevitable pushback from city council, you know, this would probably be a tough sell. But if I was king of Philadelphia for a day and not just mayor, what I would probably do is really overhaul the tax structure. And I know that's not sexy, but, you know, the wage tax is an absolutely devastating tax, and sort of related taxes like the business receipts tax and the business privilege tax and all those sorts of things. The wage tax for decades has taxed things that move, people and jobs. And when people and jobs move because the tax structure is insufficiently favorable, then like you get poverty, and you get a lot of it. And then with poverty comes social dysfunction. So until you create economic opportunity and prosperity as a baseline, it's very hard to have the civic infrastructure you need in order to make city government work. And, you know, one thing that, where I probably differentiate from my conservative friends is I have this sort of general theory that population density necessitates government, right? Government in places like the city of Philadelphia are more necessary in daily transactions than you might see in, like, you know, I don't know, Wyoming County or something, where county government is really more or less irrelevant outside of picking up the trash and making sure the sheriff's office functions. But so I'm not this, you know, let's just strip the whole thing down parts. I think that your city governments inherently need to do more than some of their counterparts in suburban and rural areas. But if you don't have a revenue model to make it work, and if you don't have economic opportunity for people to be able to realize their own potential, you just have dysfunction and chaos. And that's what we've had for the better part of 80 years. So if you just want to keep, like, if being more progressive in our politics is all Philadelphia needed, I'm looking at, you know, Chris Robb getting into the congressional race for Dwight Evans' seat in PA3. Like, that's the last person Philadelphia needs in Congress. If all we needed was more of that, the city of Philadelphia would already be a progressive utopia.
Which would be it'd be a very bad thing to be king of a progressive utopia.
Listen, I think progressive and utopia is a complete oxymoron, so I don't think it's possible, let alone me being king. But, you know, that's where we are.
You can dream in your living room, Terry Tracy. you know, let me throw some out at you, because I also know you're a thoughtful person, and thinking about the arts and music and the importance of that. And I was trying to wrap my brain around NEA, NEH, all the different cuts that are happening, and the arts community, and of course a lot of people freaking out about that here in Pennsylvania and across the nation. And these are significant cuts. And so what are your thoughts about doing that? Now, as you well know, there are many around the country, especially in places like, you know, not far from where I'm broadcasting from, the Wilma, you know, the different theaters, but also in New York City. And they're saying, oh, see, this is what fascists do. And this is what, you know, those who want to overtake, what do? They take away the arts, you know, and they take away. So what do you say to all of that, and to the budget, some tough budget cuts to NEH and NEA, obviously National Endowment for the Arts.
Yeah, well, fascists also use the arts to peddle propaganda and indoctrinate mm-hmm. people. So, you know, yeah. But you know, don't look at the programming in your local community theater anytime soon. I've actually lived this a little bit at the local level. I was, for several years, I was president of the Upper Darby Arts and Education Foundation. And my term just ended earlier this year. And my involvement there was really around restructuring. Are you familiar with Upper Darby Summer Stage?
Of course, yes.
Yeah, it's a great, it's one of the best programs in the region.
Yes.
Right? It's an absolute crown jewel. It's a great opportunity for kids. It's about the arts, but it's not about the arts. What it does for those kids is really tremendous. It operates in a community where there's, you know, a lot of folks who are not of privilege, and the underserved typically do not have, you know, equitable access to arts or arts education. So it's an organization that does great work. And the story there was that for 45 years, the township and the school district had a joint partnership. It was sort of a joint venture that was not necessarily part of any charter, but a handshake agreement where they pooled resources in order to allow this this program to survive and thrive. And for 45 years, it worked until it didn't. The government fell on hard times. You know, Upper Darby School District struggles tremendously. The township has like an $11 million structural deficit and is raising taxes and fees everywhere you look. And the reality was that funding that program was going to be untenable in the long term. And so what we had to do is we had to say, if you're going to put this program or at least the funding sources back into the third sector, what does that look like? Because we can't continue to rely on the taxpayer to subsidize this based on all the other strains. And so, I mean, I was certainly, you know, frustrated with the fact that a program like that might be at risk based on fiscal pressures in the government.
Mm-hmm.
And the transition to the third sector or a third sector is not an easy one, but it was a necessary one. And that foundation that supports Upper Darby Summer Stage and its other arts and arts education programs is now thriving. They just celebrated the 50th anniversary there 2 weeks ago. They had thousands of people out. They're opening a year-round art center in the eastern end of the township that is partially being funded by ARPA money, which is actually a good use of ARPA money. Bad bill, good use if you're going to spend it. And they've been able to use that to actually raise awareness about the programming and attract substantial donors that will allow that program to thrive for years to come. So in many ways, it's a success story. Not easy. It's much easier when you just have the government's needle in your arm. Don't get me wrong, because mm-hmm. the check comes and it clears. But it's also not sustainable because you have to make choices. And so the question becomes, is the arts really what you want the government to do?
Mm-hmm.
And it's not like we're going to zero. I just think that, you know, just like you want governments and markets to be distinct social forces in a healthy democracy, I would argue you want government and arts to be distinct social forces as well. And where there's overlap, and maybe I'm at 50,000 feet, you know, you could get into some more specifics about who's being heard and how you mm-hmm. fix it. I lived it in Delaware County. It's not easy, but it is doable. And if your product is sufficiently commercial, you're going to attract people who want to make sure it survives. It's kind of like newspapers. Like this is what I do every day, right? The Inquirer is a lousy product at the end of the day. That's their problem. There's all kinds of macro issues with media, yes, but it's not a good product. And so, but if you sell a good product, everyone wants information, put good information, people will ensure that it survives and it thrives. And I think there's probably within the arts community some soul searching that needs to be done about the kind of product that's being put out there as well, and whether or not, you know, the taxpayer ought to fund that and whether they even want that. So, you know, there's some foundational questions there, really.
Hey, y'all, Poodle and Maddie here from Reality Gaze. Grab your favorite thong, because for the first time, we're heading to the villa for the new season of Love Island USA.
I can't wait to watch Ariana babysit these shiny, oiled up adults who I'm pretty sure aren't there for the right reasons.
From the home-wrecking bombshells to the absolute wreckage of movie night.
Pull up a daybed and join us every Wednesday for all the Love Island USA drama.
Find Reality Gaze wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah, I love it. I didn't even know that you were on that board, but Upper Darby Arts and Education Foundation, that whole, wasn't that part, in part, that was a Tina Fey had praised it? Am I right there? Is that part of that?
Yeah. She had, Tina was a big supporter, has been, she's an alumni of the program, and of the high school, that when she wrote Mean Girls, which is a movie, and it's also, it was on Broadway. I don't know if it still is, but that was actually based on her experience going to Upper Darby High School. So, and her parents, I think until recently, still lived in the town. So she has deep roots there. She has been a benefactor there. She has been an inspiration to many young women who wanted to get involved in the arts, who have followed her up to New York and done all kinds of things. And there's a number of other very successful alumni as well who are doing national tours and are on Broadway and are producers and directors. So it's really a tremendous program. And, you know, but that sort of, you know, government taxpayer art, this was a little bit different because it's kids in education. Yeah. So I think you can make a different case for it, but still at the end of the day, the government has put itself in, over the course of many years, a position where it just cannot maintain all of these obligations. So you have to make tough choices. And I say that as an advocate and supporter of the arts, not as someone who's, you know, just critical.
Yeah, I always say to people, because I've had relatives where I'll say, oh, you know, my sons, you know, absolutely, they're on the stage, they're in musicals and plays since the schools had it, since they were little. And they'll say, oh, that's, you know, especially for boys, I'll say, it's a life skill. So my sons did sports. I mean, big kids playing high school football and whatnot, but also star of the musical or in the musical, you know, because it's a life skill.
Yeah. So variety is the spice of life, right? And it really is. I mean, your ability to get up there in front of people and present yourself in whatever capacity that is, playing a trumpet or being in a play or doing, you know, like I forget what the phonics and speech stuff, like whatever, regardless, that is, those skills are invaluable when you go through life. It builds confidence. You know, it exposes you to like real diversity, not just box checking diversity, but diversity in every sense of the word, in a way that just makes you, and you know, me coming out of Upper Darby, I would say really prepared me very well for life because it was real, authentic diversity with opportunity to participate in everything. Like you said, sports and arts and challenging academic. But what you see is, you know, in a place like that, they've cut the advanced placement program. Mm-hmm. It's gone. You know, the arts program was at risk and needed to be substantially restructured. The graduation rate is at 57% or 67%. These are real issues. And they sort of go back to my earlier point, which is that the government's primary responsibility, outside of just like, you know, the basic service it's chartered to provide, is to create a foundation for prosperity. And when you have these progressive policies that destroy your fiscal position and, you know, drive social dysfunction up, economic opportunity down, and it leaves nothing but chaos around you and social dysfunction, you get these massive structural problems that are really, really difficult to change. And, you know, the problems that we see in the city are the policy problems and that sort of ideological framework in which these local governments are operating as they become more and more blue or deeper blue. The problems that we see in the city are becoming pervasive throughout the region. And so, yes, things like opportunity for kids and the arts are put at risk. And that's the joke, right? Because these are the folks who often on the campaign trail will put themselves out there as being the most staunch advocates for these things. But they're not willing to focus on the fundamentals of government that are required in order for them to be able to prosper.
So today, one of my themes, I'm just asking everybody, the big, beautiful bill, what do you like about it? What do you hate about it? What do you think about it?
I'm going to sound like a broken record because I think every time I come on your show, I say this. I really hate the dysfunction in Congress. I really do not like these bills, as a matter of principle. I don't like all of these policy bills that are jammed through the reconciliation process that are this like conglomerate of different policy considerations that make having even a rational conversation about the efficacy of the bill or the policies possible. And, you know, like, I don't even know what we're talking about. Are we talking about the Medicaid piece, the immigration piece, the economic piece? So, like, I just think it's bad for the country generally. I mean, I think Obamacare, we would all agree, is a disaster. I think 99% of people believe or have no idea that part of the reason that higher education costs are so out of whack is because when everyone was focused on Obamacare getting passed, they passed this the student loan reform. They attached it to that reconciliation bill that basically allowed the government to nationalize student lending and has created all kinds of problems throughout higher ed, not just the financial problems, but even the problems with, you know, boys and women's sports and all the problems. Mm-hmm. Because you have all of these education bureaucrats that are making, you know, huge six-figure salaries at the top of the ivory tower, making really wacky decisions. So, like, and that never got the day in its sun that it should have back in 09 when Obamacare was passed, because it was just thrown in there last minute to a reconciliation bill. So as a matter of both process and politics, I hate these kinds of bills.
Yeah.
That being said, when you get into it, there's good stuff in there, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, the Democrats, I think, are, again, like, Trump just runs circles around them with the politics of these things.
Yeah.
They're focusing on the Medicaid thing. I get it. I think top line, that's what makes the bill seem unpopular. But I saw a survey earlier this week that said 68% of Americans believe there should be a work requirement for Medicaid, and a majority of Democrats.
Because it's actually good for you, right? I mean, I've had this conversation with relatives. It's actually good for every one of us to, you know, put on your clothes in the morning, brush your teeth, and go to a job. It's good for your physical health, your mental health. If you're single or divorced and you meet people, do you know what I'm saying? It's actually, we're
totally
meant to get up and walk somewhere and do something to
and
simplify.
I believe community service is even one of the options.
Yes.
If you can't find a job, but you're helping a nonprofit do something good, go help the Upper Darby Arts and Education Foundation open their new arts center, and you get to have Medicaid. Like, it's not a bad deal. So I think they're making a mistake by dying on that hill.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, this is a massive economic bet, and the execution and implementation of the bill and the return economically on the bill is going to determine whether or not it's a success. But, you know, the early signs show that, you know, the markets are favorable, and I think the only risk there is sort of how the tariff situation potentially complicates the economic picture.
Yeah.
But I think the things that they did in the bill around immigrant, and look, as much as I want to be sort of pie in the sky or intellectually pure about this is the way which Congress would work, I understand who's in Congress and what we're dealing with. And I think Mike Johnson is a really impressive guy. Very, very impressive. And if this is what he needed to do to get some common sense legislation passed so we can stop doing what I hate even more, which is just governing by executive order, and then it all gets reversed in, you know, whenever, then I'll take it. But it's kind of a, you know, it's a compromise I don't love. But it is certainly better than the alternatives. So we'll see. It's a big economic bet.
So the today's edition, hot off the press for Broad and Liberty, one of the pictures I love is 1976 by Centennial photo of Philadelphia. And from the editors, is Philly ready for America 250? But you said you were going to break news. Are you breaking news about that? Or what are you breaking news about? You were texting.
No, I do. I do have a little news.
You do?
So we have a little news. We heard over the weekend from the Pennsylvania News Media Association that Broad and Liberty is being awarded Best Investigative Journalism in Pennsylvania.
Woohoo! Congratulations.
And it's really a credit to Todd Shepard and his work, particularly his work on the mismanagement of the Delaware County government, in particular the prison. I mean, that place, you know, got a ton of coverage from the Inquirer, and no one ever told the other side of the story. And it's been a disaster, and Todd's been on it. And so he's got a big award coming his way, and it's well-deserved, and we're proud. And it's with the big boys. I mean, we're competing with the Inquirer and the Post-Gazette and Spotlight PA. So we haven't told anyone yet. You're the first one. You and you know, all however many hundred thousands of your best friends. But well, yeah, we're proud.
We are celebrating. We are proud. Congratulations, seriously, to Broad and Liberty, all your hard work, Todd Shepard, and also Terry Tracy, King of the Day. We named you King of the Day.
I'll take it. I don't get that at home.
You're a legend. Thank in your God. Living room. Hey, Terry, it's always, you're always refreshing and brilliant, so thank you.
Dawn Stensland from Talk Radio 1210 WPHT. You've built a great podcast. The content's solid. The audience is growing. But the money, still not where it should be. That's where the Odyssey Creator Lab comes in. We host your podcast for free so you can keep doing your thing while our experienced sales team does their thing, finding advertisers and bringing in revenue. No fees, no stress, just real monetization. Apply now at creators.odyssey.com and let us show you the money.